Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, welcome to episode 99 of Write Club the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather, and I'm in the chair today, and I'm joined by Linda, Stephanie, Teresa.
Hello.
Hi. Hi.
Today, Teresa will be reading from her work in progress. Steph will be amusing us with some colourful language. Later on, we'll be talking about editing. I'll have to listen to that bit because it's one of the things I'm really not very good at. And Nicola will be telling us what's on her bedside table. But first of all, Pat is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Well, apologies to Linda for this one because it's very British and I really don't think she'll be familiar with it. But anyway, here we go. The novel was published in 1935. It's the fourth of a series which satirised upper middle class British life in the 20s and 30s. The series consists of six novels and two short stories. But this is probably the most well known. And the author has been compared to P.G. Woodhouse and Jane Austen.
Oh, I thought it was P.G. Woodhouse. Damn.
Well, yeah, I wrote down Jeeves and Worcester, so...
That goes.
Oh, now.
Well, she was totally right. I have no idea. I'll take a nap while you finish this.
Okay. No ideas? Well, clue two. It's described as a subtly brilliant comedy of social rivalry between the wars. A deliciously entertaining, wickedly exciting war of garden parties, bridge evenings, and staggeringly simple little dinners. Two of the most formidable ladies in English literature collide, elegantly, maliciously, and amusingly, in a town named Tilling, which is recognisably based on Rye in East Sussex, where the author lived for many years and served as mayor from 1934.
That really gave me a big clue, but I can't remember who the author is.
I
thought it was earlier than that, actually. I thought it was written earlier, but maybe that was the first
the
few
mayor.
In the series.
The mayor of Rye wrote some books.
I can't remember his name, but I know the book. I know the book now.
Good.
Well, once again,
you've lost me.
Heather, you're British.
Yes.
No? Clue three. And I think this might give it you. The last three novels were produced as a television series during 1985 to 1986, featuring Nigel Hawthorne, Geraldine McEwan and Prunella Scales. The first five have been adapted for BBC Radio 4, and there was a three-part adaptation written by Steve Pemberton, which was broadcast in December 2014. The central character of the novel, or one of the two ladies, was described by her best friend, Georgie, as a hypocrite, a poseuse, a sham and a snob, but there was something about her that stirred you into violent though protesting activity, and though she might infuriate you, she prevented your being dull.
I know it.
I want to say Hinge and Bracket.
No.
But I know that's not right.
It's Map and Lucia.
Yes.
And I think it's Benson, but I can't remember.
Right, I don't know the author.
I thought they were earlier.
I thought they were earlier too.
But she did say it was the fourth in the series.
Yeah, I think probably the first three were earlier.
Right, it's actually available as a series on Amazon Prime, Map and Lucia.
Right.
And the novel was Map and Lucia. As I said, it was the fourth one of the series. The first novels focused on either Map or Lucia separately in their own little sort of queendoms. And then this was the first novel that brought them together. Written by E.F. Benson, who incidentally was the younger brother of Arthur Christopher Benson, who wrote the words to Land of Hope and Glory. Sorry, Linda, I really don't think you had a chance with that one.
Well done, Stephanie.
Well, right. I didn't. You were right, Pip.
You had a good nap, though.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, girly swat.
Well, I knew it. I tell you why I knew it, because I actually used the first two books in my novel as a book that was read by my protagonist. That's how I knew it. And that's why I knew that they were earlier, because I was looking for a book that would have been current in a particular year. And I remember, and it was the first one. And then when she left home, my brothers bought her the second book in the series that had just come out.
Right.
And that's why I knew that they were earlier. Because I've already researched it a long time ago. I can't pretend I've read them recently.
Yeah. We don't have a television, so as it's getting close to winter, I often download things to watch, which is why I know that it's on Amazon Prime at the moment.
Right.
Okay, thank you. And now it's over to Teresa, who's going to read from her work in progress.
Okay, so the story's moved on a little bit, and Ranella has persuaded this teenage gang, to kind of take her in rather than hand her over to the authorities for the time being. Pyramid Mountain didn't look right. Ranella was looking at it from the wrong side. She thought about Grandpa Leo and Aunt Marta beyond the mountains. She wondered what they would say about the boy she was with, the boy who called himself Kirk. She still had the tiny hidden weapon, but she couldn't use it against him. She drew snakes in the dirty window pane, looking out over the concrete apartment buildings, mostly empty and run down, to the wild country beyond. Kes should be fully recovered by now. She knew he would be on her trail, but wasn't sure he could track her over tarmac and paving stones up six flights of stairs. She had left clues where she could, scuffing the ground and breaking plants, drawing snakes in the dirt. As they entered the block, she'd stopped to tie a bootlace, pressing her hand against the glass door and knocking some dirt from her boot. She had tried. "Come away from the window." Ranella sat in a shabby armchair. The boy was looking at her strangely again. It was weird, Ranella thought, seeing Aunt Marta's eyes in this young boy's face. He sat beside her. "I want to know about your tattoos," he said. Ranella showed her arm. "The lion is for my grandfather, Leotrim," she started cautiously. "We call him Grandpa Leo." The boy was looking at his own arm, comparing it with hers. He didn't speak. "My grandmother Estrella is the star." Again he looked at his own identical mark. Again he said nothing. "The next two are my parents, a cross for my dad Stavro and a flower for my mum Genta." He looked her in the face now but remained silent. "The leaf," he looked at the leaf on his own arm, "is where I come from, Chestnut Village. The snake is me." His glance shot to the smeared window, a mess of wriggling snakes. "Who are you signalling?" He grabbed her arms and shook her. The door crashed open and there was Kes, a hunting knife in his hand. The boy grabbed for his own knife as Kes sprang across the room. Ranella threw herself on the boy and shouted, "Don't hurt him! He's my cousin, Tolly!" Kes dropped his arm. Ranella looked at the boy. "No fighting, okay?" "I'm not your cousin. My name's Kirk." His face was red and his eyes wide with anger. "Let me go. Don't make me hurt you." "Okay, but let's talk. You can't fight both of us." She eased her grip on the boy. "This is my friend Kes. He won't hurt you, will you, Kes?" Kes grinned in response. "He's just looking for me." Ranella sat back in the chair. The boy had his elbows on his knees, his hands pressed to his eyes. "What are you doing here? What's going on?" He sounded tearful. Ranella took a deep breath. She wasn't sure she could trust him. She looked at Kes. He shrugged as if to say, "It's up to you." "We're looking for my sister," she said. "The tattoos can help us find her. Will you help?" The boy smeared tears across his face. He held out his arm and pointed to the sword, the tree and the hammer, the three tattoos that were different to Ronella's. "What about these?" he said. "Who are they?"
Brilliant. I love the idea of the tattoos. I think that's a really, really clever.
Yeah.
It certainly is.
A really clever idea.
Yeah. But I'm surprised that, I guess I was expecting, because, you know, she saw him before and thought earlier, she thought it was him, her cousin. And I was thinking that when he finally came to realize that, he would be so happy. But he's not.
Oh, I've forgotten that. Yeah, well, he's been there such a long time, hasn't he?
Yeah, I was going to ask, how long has he been there? What age was he when he was
a toddler, so sort of 18 months to 2 years old. Okay. So as far as he's concerned, his parents are his parents.
Right, right.
And he's never really questioned the marks on his arm.
Right.
Until he sees hers.
Yeah.
And we have to assume that within this city there are other children, or within the wider community, there are other children with similar tattoos.
Mm, right.
But it's just that they obviously have so many in common.
Right.
You know.
Mm. There was one bit, the paragraph that starts, he looked into her face now but remained silent. Mm-hmm. The leaf, he looked at the leaf on his own arm, is where I come from. I thought that was him talking, not Ranella, because
yes,
the way that all the action was from him, and yes, even though it was her speaking. So I think
I need to say Ranella continued or something,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
You're right.
And there was a little bit earlier on where you said she still had the tiny hidden weapon but couldn't use it against him. I think you could perhaps expand a little bit on that and have a bit more show and tell. So she strokes the tiny hidden weapon, shudders as she imagines it sinking in or something like that. But because I get that she couldn't use it against him because he's her cousin, but I'm not sure the reader would necessarily
that. Make more of it. Yeah.
But apart from that, it's brilliant.
One thing I thought of myself as I'm reading it is, why doesn't Kirk stroke Tolly question the fact that a longhead has just leapt into the room as well? So I probably need to say something about that.
She was saying, he's my friend and he's just looking for me, etc. Normally you wouldn't have been
say, you know, but he's a longhead or something. Yeah. So I do need to put that in.
Right.
For God's sake, he's a longhead. Is
it too much of a coincidence that at the very minute they're talking about who's looking for her, that he comes in?
Maybe. If you think so, then it probably is. I was thinking she's drawing on the window.
Yes.
You know.
I didn't think that when I read it myself.
Mm.
I think it was just when you read it out now that it sounded very...
Yeah, and maybe when she's drawing the snakes on the window, that's what initiates the conversation. He says, why do you keep drawing snakes? And she says, because snakes are me, look. And then
she's telling him that she's signalling, so that wouldn't work.
Oh,
that
won't work.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've kind of referred to her leaving clues.
Yes.
And made
right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, so I don't
know. I think it's fine. Just that it just as you read it, I thought, oh, that's a big coincidence to just say, who are you signalling?
Okay.
And actually, she's thrown herself on Tolly. And if Tolly's about to attack Kez, she may just as well have thrown herself on Kez and said to Tolly, don't hurt him. So in a way, she needs to stand between them.
Well, the idea of in my mind, because Kez is so fast and so strong, she can't stop him.
Right.
She can get between him and Tolly.
Yeah. Right.
That was my logic there.
Yeah.
However,
excellent,
but wonderful, and it just makes me every time I read a little bit, I just want to read more.
Yeah. I know, I love it, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen next. And where is Larkin?
Yes,
and please tell me that when you find Larkin, or if she finds Larkin, if that happens, and I hope it does, that you're not just going to cut us off short and say the end, because
what? There's a lot of things to work out.
But there's a big question, isn't there? Is Tolly going to go back with him, or is Tolly going to choose to stay? Because he's been living in the city since he was a toddler, that's going to be a tough one.
Maybe he
recently read an article about a woman who had been stolen at birth, and the whole thing about the story of who stole her and all that kind of thing. But she was brought up with this family all her life, and then her birth mother found her But when she met her birth mother, there was no connection. She didn't feel anything for her because she felt for the people who brought her up.
Yes.
So even though she now knew there was some...
That's the tragedy of those kind of situations.
Yeah, an element of, you know, who stole her from the hospital and all of that kind of thing. But to her, it didn't matter. Her parents were her parents.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she wanted to carry on having a relationship with them. She really wasn't that interested in getting to know her birth mother.
Well, I think that answers your question, really, because in my mind, you know, there's no way Tolly is going to leave and go back to Marta. Although, you know, if it was possible to have some communication between them, he would. He'll send a message to her. But... you know, he can't. He can't. Right. You know, he doesn't feel he can.
Lots of the other children that have been there for a long time can't go back. Right. That's going to be the tough lesson, isn't it?
It is. If you don't get them
quickly,
there's no way back. Mm.
But at least she will be comforted by knowing that he's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's not.
Yeah, he's being looked after.
Yeah.
And in the future, you know, if I ever finish this book, and if there was a sequel, you know, they've got a friend in the enemy camp then.
Yes, they're
for future adventures.
That's right. And maybe that will heal the division between them. But, I said what I said about not ending so abruptly because I get so annoyed when a book I'm reading, a good book, and I'm in love with the characters and I feel like family, and then... the resolution comes, and they just...
It's wrapped up too quickly.
And I think, wait a minute, let me in. I want to go back.
If every book you read like that, there'll be another book where you think, oh, you could have finished this at the end of the, you know, the third but last chapter.
Maybe. Yes.
And I don't really need to know all the ins and outs and the time.
I can't remember now, but there has been a book that I just thought, okay, that's the end. Oh, no, there's another chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now it's the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've ended it three times now.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, that's true. That happens. And especially in movies, again, I feel like, wait, let me go home and have a cup of coffee with you. I know you guys are going to go talk about it or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel sad when that happens.
Well,
so.
I hope that I can write an ending that will satisfy you.
And it'd be the first of many. J.K. Rowling started with one novel.
That's right.
Yeah.
These are such great characters and such a great world you've created.
Oh, thank you.
So over to Steph, who's going to share some colourful language.
Well, yes. As everyone around this table knows, I'm in the process of buying a new house. And so my mind has been turning to choosing decor and soft furnishings. You know, it's an opportunity to get some new bits and pieces in. And so I've been looking at, you know, cushions and curtains and carpets and that sort of thing. I've been absolutely stunned by the names of all the colours. There are so many names of colours. You know, you've got delphinium blue, Parisian blue, satin blue, every blue under the sun. Reds, antique red, brick red, awning red, emperor's silk red. Greens are endless as well. I mean, the colours, as they're described, are just amazing. And obviously there's a job somewhere just to get creative about naming colours. But it really turned my mind to thinking about all those idioms around colour as well. So, you know, we've got green-fingered, yellow-bellied, white elephant, browned off, golden opportunities, red tape, black male, black sheep, bolts from the blue, blue-eyed boys. You know, I mean, so, so many uses of colour as part of the idiom in our language. And I thought, well, where would our glorious language be if it weren't for all of the colours?
Very drab.
So it would be very drab and not colourful at all. Anyway, that set me thinking about how the colours were named in the first place, because obviously it's obvious that perhaps orange is called orange because oranges are orange. But why is the colour of the sky called blue? Why isn't it just called sky? Okay. So that set me thinking. So I just went and it's better than writing, wasn't it? So I went off and had a little investigate, and I found an essay by somebody called Melissa on a website called todayifoundout.com, which is going to be one of my favourite places to go, I think. And she's actually looked into this, and she said, this is a fascinating fact, that according to linguists, that the everyday colours are found named in the earliest languages. But the weird thing is that in every culture and society, the names of the colours were named in the same order. Mm-hmm. So every culture and language and society first named black, then white, then red, green, yellow, and then blue.
Mm.
And colours like pink and purple and orange came a lot, lot later. So they were only...
As more subtly, subtlety is required, yeah, presumably. Yeah, the language, yeah, then, mm, needs some distinction. Oh.
So let me just tell you that there was, in Europe, India, Iran and Anatolia, the earliest understood, or the common ancestor of all the languages of that region, is what we call Proto-Indo-European, or PI. Okay, so it's just for you to know that. And that then developed into a kind of Proto-Germanic, which included English, Norse, Norwegian, Danish and so on. And that then morphed into Old English. So I'm only really going to focus on the English, mm-hmm, names for colours. So, for example, in PI, the Proto-Indo-European language, the word black derives from words which meant dark, ink and to burn. And I guess that's because when things are burned, they become charred and blackened.
Right.
So, so, for example, in the 4th millennium BC, in that Pi language, the word was bleg, B-H-L-E-G, bleg.
Huh.
And then over time, that changed to blackass, then to blacken, then to blake in Old English. And that last word, blake, also meant ink. And in Old Saxon, it was black. And in Swedish, it became black. And the Old Norse was black. So that's like a cur with a slight R after, mm-hmm, it. Black, like that. So that's where black came from. So it meant burnt or dark.
Mm.
And then white began as quintos, which simply meant bright or white. And that's been changed over time so that in Old English, it became quit. And then that subsequently become right. And I won't go through all of them, but red, green, yellow, blue, they all followed a similar path. But we will put the link to this article on our Facebook, mm, group, because it is, if you are interested in how, yeah, colours were named, it's fascinating. It's curious about how every culture and language named them in the same order.
Yeah.
But it's now been established by scientists that, in fact, the human brain reacts to colours. So it reacts most violently to black, second to white, and then red, green, yellow, blue. So that naming of colours seems to follow our kind of cognizance,
hmm,
as we developed, of colours. So as Teresa said, the, yeah, the more curious colours, you know, the less obvious colours were named a lot later. So, for example, brown is derived from the Old Germanic for a dark colour or a shining darkness. And it's quite a recent addition to our language because it's only been known since about 1000 AD.
Huh.
So we had 3,000 years of not naming the colour brown,
mm-hmm,
after,
mm-hmm,
we'd named black and,
yeah,
so on.
Yeah.
Purple sprung up in the 9th century AD in Old English as purple, which was borrowed from the Latin word that meant purple colour, purple dyed cloak or purple dye. Or was the name of the shellfish from which purple was made. Mm-hmm. And actually, purple originally meant splendidly attired.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't actually mean the colour. It meant it was a kind of way of saying somebody was splendidly attired.
As in purple prose as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're so purple today.
And as I predicted, so orange derives from the Sanskrit word for the fruit, naranja.
Mm-hmm.
Fruit was called a naranja, and that was the name that was given to the colour, mm-hmm, that matched it, mm, which made me wonder why we didn't call it carrot. But then I realised that carrots in India are, mm, purple, aren't they? They're different colours, mm, all over the world, and,
yeah,
the same as tomatoes. Although I have got tomato red as one of my colours for my new scheme. So naranja, and that then transformed into Arabic and Persian. And the time it got to French, it was pomme d'orange. And it was originally recorded in English as the name of a colour in 1512.
Mm.
Now, this is quite important because, you know, we've talked before about making sure that when you're writing historical novels, you, mm, know what's happening in the time. You, right, could not describe somebody back in biblical times as wearing an orange cloak, mm, or an orange, mm, dress, right, or something, because the word orange didn't exist.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
Similarly, if you're writing in medieval times, you're writing about the Tudor court, you wouldn't refer to anything as pink, because pink wasn't actually described until 1733. In the 16th century, pink was actually a name that was used to describe a plant that had petals with a variety of colours. Mm. So probably in, you know, the 15th and 16th century, people would have been wearing rose,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, it would have been given a name. The word pink didn't exist. But
there are flowers that are called pinks.
Yes, I'm sure there are. Mm. I'm sure there are.
And they could have been before
the
colour.
That could have been the colour, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, today I'm pleased to report that I am in the pink. That is in rude health.
Was it Coco Chanel who invented the colour beige?
I don't know. I didn't
And I think it was a combination of brun and neige, you know, brown and snow. But so that's a colour that's possibly only been around about 100 years or less.
Really?
But also, I remember on QI years ago, it was said that the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for blue, which is very peculiar.
Mm.
But in modern Greek, they use ble, which is clearly imported from French.
Yeah,
you know, it's like there is no Greek word for blue.
Right.
Which is bizarre.
Is that perhaps because there's not a single word for blue?
Mm.
There's perhaps a whole...
They have other words, I'm trying to think, they seem to me to be all imports.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, which puts a different complexion on Homer's Wine Dark Sea.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. It does, yeah.
I've always wondered...
They didn't have blue wine, though.
No, exactly. No, no.
But I have always wondered, in reading Homer, why he uses that phrase, the wine dark sea.
I know, because when you see the sea in Greece, 99% of the time it's not dark, it's clear,
and
pellucid,
blue.
And blue. But on a stormy day, or on a cloudy day, rare as they are, you can see that it's dark.
Yeah, I can see that. And if it was battle and it was dusk or something like that, it could have been lighter colours.
But I don't know. It's an epithet, isn't it, that is used again and again. It's, you know... It just goes with the sea in Homer, doesn't it? It's not really descriptive.
Same as fleet-footed Achilles. Is,
right. So you'd have to... And the rosy fingers of dawn is mentioned repeatedly. In...
Okay, thank you, Steph. Now we're going to talk about editing. And as I said earlier, this is one of the things that I'm really, really not very good at. Hopeless at trying to edit my own work, and sometimes offended when other people edit mine and tell me where I've gone wrong. So I think Steph's got something to share.
Well, I think the first thing that I would say about editing, and I've spent a long time editing, is there are a few things that you might call editing, which personally I think are part of just a sort of standard doing your work. When you're working, I think spell check's always a good idea. I know sometimes we turn it off because then we can just get the words out and worry about it later. But there are lots of tools that you can get your work ready to edit. So it's things like spelling, grammar, punctuation, format. So, you know, you need to make sure that you're using a font that's readable, this line spacing, indent, section breaks and so on. So I'm going to assume...
Apply the conventions,
yeah. I'm going to assume, really, that all that's done. But there's a couple of lovely tools that I found on the Writers and Artists website, which is writersandartists.co.uk. And they've got on there some self-editing tools under the title of Spring Clean Your Manuscript. And they've got a tool there where you can paste your work onto the website, and it counts the frequency with which you use words and phrases. So, it will tell you if you're overusing a particular... We've all got little ticks, haven't we?
Yes.
Where we might be saying simply or likely, or there's a word that we all like to use.
I always use so.
Yeah.
So, and I have to be careful.
Yeah. But it will tell you, it will count for you both words that you've used, and then you can ask it to look for two or three or four word phrases and it will count them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you were Homer and it kept saying you're talking about fleet-footed Achilles, that's fine because you've deliberately done that because that's an epithet. But if it wasn't deliberate, that's a way of highlighting it for you. Not that Homer had access to it, of course. The other one, and I know Nicola's a great fan of this, is the Hemingway app,
mm-hmm.
which you can get... online. You can get it through the Writers and Artists website, but you can also get it in its own right. And what that does is, you paste your work in and it will look at the technical side of your writing. And it colour codes your writing to point out things like adverbs, sentences that are very long, passages that could be simplified, the use of the passive voice. And now, bear in mind, this is a computer that's doing this. It's not a human being. So you do have to have a little bit of nous about you and accept it blindly. But it is quite useful to see, you know, if there are overly long sentences. And it will actually give you a score and tell you how readable your work is. But I remember we did on one of our podcasts, we actually put some of the well-known openings to novels through Hemingway, and Hemingway didn't necessarily give it particularly good scores.
Right.
So it doesn't mean everything, but it's a good tool to check that you're ready to start editing. And then there's a number of different ways of editing and a number of different things that you might want to think about editing, and you might want to think about a professional editor, or you might want to do it yourself. But I know, Teresa, you've got a checklist, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got...
The do-it-yourself...
Yeah, the ultimate self-editing checklist from jerryjenkins.com. And I don't know if Jerry is a man or a woman, but it doesn't matter. Let's assume it's a woman. So what she says, check that you have deleted throat clearing, as she calls it, so freeing the opening of unnecessary scene setting, backstory, background information, or anything else that keeps you from just getting on with the story. Check that you have chosen the simple word over the complicated one. Anywhere I could have simplified, I have. I mean, again, you have to take that with a pinch of salt if you're writing something, a historical novel, in the voice of a person from that era. You might choose a more sophisticated language. Omitted needless words, that's another one. She also says, have I deleted even subtle redundancies, such as he clapped his hands?
Ah.
He just clapped. Say he clapped. Or he shrugged his shoulders. He shrugged. Right. We know what he's shrugging.
You can't shrug your hands, can you?
No.
Or clap your shoulders.
Clap your shoulders.
Exactly. She also says deleted up and down, except where necessary. I presume this is sat down, stood up. Perhaps you don't need, you can say he sat. Deleted that, except when necessary for clarity. And I think I'm guilty of saying he opened the window that was to the right of him, or something. You don't really need that. But that wasn't a good example.
Oh, it's a very good example.
Have you, she suggests, check that you haven't over-explained. So instead of he walked through the open door and sat down in a chair, you could write he walked in and sat in a chair.
Right.
Because you wouldn't walk through a closed door.
Right.
Have you avoided quotation marks around words used in another context, as if the reader wouldn't otherwise get it?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is the equivalent of doing air apostrophes, when you apostrophize or you put it something in speech marks to aid the very dumb reader in understanding. don't dumb down. Have you avoided telling what's not happening? No, I haven't, in the bit that I read to you earlier, such as he didn't respond or the room never quieted, which I don't, that's a very awkward construction. But I have it with Tolly said he didn't speak several times. However, she suggests avoiding that. Have you used strong nouns and verbs instead of overusing adjectives and adverbs? And we've covered this at length, haven't we? The idea of instead of saying he tiptoed quietly, you could say he crept, those sorts of things.
Yeah, or he walked slowly, he trudged.
Yeah. Have you avoided hedging words such as smiled slightly, almost laughed, etc.? Okay, there may be better ways of conveying those ideas. And again, controversially, she says, have you deleted the term literally when you actually mean figuratively?
Oh, I love that one. Yay, that's my favourite.
But as we have discovered, literally can also mean figuratively. It has changed its meaning and usage. So,
not in my book, it hasn't.
No, I know. So, and have you, finally, she says, have you deleted unnecessary stage direction, telling my reader only what he or she needs to know in each scene, nothing more? Okay, so it's getting down to the essence.
Yeah, to make sure that every passage tells a story. The other thing I think, once you've kind of done these initial things to make sure it's as tidy as it can be. Stephen King, in his book on writing, says that he always puts his finished drafts in a drawer for at least 6 weeks. Mm. Doesn't look at them again, because you need to really get that distance. Because when it's something that you're so close to, how can you possibly notice all these things?
Yeah. I think that's a very good idea. Well, I'm looking at, to add to what Teresa was saying, a book called On Editing, How to Edit Your Novel the Professional Way by Helen Corner Bryant and Catherine Price. And in a section here called The First Cut is the Deepest, they talk about what do you look for when you're wondering what to cut. She has a list of things like inner voice, overlong descriptions, excess information, florid language, repetition, figurative language and cliches, recapping, summing up passages you love. I struggle with those sometimes. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, that is such a great saying. But if it serves no purpose, it has to go out.
Oh, I tell you what I've started doing, because I had a few that I really, really loved. I'd come up with these wonderful phrases. I thought they were wonderful, and they obviously didn't want to be there. So I created a file called Unused Prose. And now, instead of deleting them, I just cut them and put them in that file. So they're there for me to go back and my wonderful phrases up. So I haven't actually killed my babies.
Yeah, that's
right. I've just put them in an orphanage for now.
Well, I kind of, I have something like that. I just call it bits. And I keep it, you know, the file is in the tray. So when there's something, it's easy for me to get to and just paste it right in. Because I'm the same. I can't, there's some things that I think, well, I have to use it someday because it's that good. They offer here, she offers a passage that is written with all of these flaws, pretty much in it. And then they edit it, and it is so much more concise and readable and tight. So I'd just like to read a sample of these, if that's all right.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. This says, the fair-haired gentleman caught her arm. His eyes were cornflower blue, his jaw wide and generous, his face sunburnt, and the hair that had first caught her eye curled down to his neckline in soft rings. He wore a faded velveteen jerkin the same color as his eyes, with a gold brocade cravat poking delicately out of it.
Oh, God.
And a heavy, ornate watch chain dangling from one pocket. His boots were of strong leather, no wrestling with the mud for him, and altogether he seemed like a nobleman but one dressed for countryside life. And then she said, she looked up into his face to see that he was giving her a reassuring smile. Let me take you to meet the servants, he said. Now, here's the edited version. That was long.
Mm. Yeah, and it's that thing as well of, like, you're trying to create a picture in the reader's mind instead of letting them see who they want to see in that
role. Actually, I'm confused because I'm thinking probably what the author's trying to do is say, this is a nobleman dressed for the country, and he's very handsome and good-looking, and he appears to be quite fond of her.
Right.
That's it, really, isn't it?
And the author loves the clothes he's wearing.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't seem suitable for the country to me, with his gold brocade cravat. But however,
and his heavy boots. And
the boots, yeah.
And he's rich, I think, as well, because he's going to afford nice clothes.
Yeah. Do you want to?
Yes, let's hear it.
So much shorter. A tall, fair-haired gentleman she had spotted from the window of the carriage was holding out a hand. She cleared her throat and stumbled forward, her shoes sticking. In a previous paragraph, the author described how her shoes were inappropriate for this.
Yeah.
Why hadn't I thought about the proper attire? Why I was on this long ride and I didn't prepare, blah, blah, blah. And here they've just condensed that into this paragraph saying, she cleared her throat and stumbled forward, her shoes sticking. Very concise.
Yeah.
And then he caught her arm and she felt the strength beneath his faded velveteen jerkin. She looked up into his eyes to see that he was smiling. With his hair curling down his sunburnt cheek, he looked like a farmhand, but his gold cravat and the watch chain poking from a pocket made her wonder. Let me take you to meet the servants, he said.
That's brilliant.
Okay, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines here in the edited version, in the book lines, versus, oh my, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, oh, there must be, what, 12, 14, 15 lines here at least.
Yeah.
And it's so much more readable here, mm-hmm. isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I mean, I don't like when I get all bogged down in all those
I think the thing about too much description of a person's appearance, and again, you know, you just need to sketch a couple of details and yeah. let the reader imagine yeah, their own.
Exactly. And the very specific detail right. there of the cravat and the watch.
Yes.
Yeah, that's all it took.
That's all it took.
Yeah. Those two pieces yeah. describe him perfectly. Yeah. I mean, I think yeah. he does. Yeah. And he looked like a farmer, but he was wearing
his yeah, face. Exactly.
Yeah. I hate
and
it.
And also,
when
she hasn't said in the second, or he hasn't said in the second passage, that the smile was reassuring.
Right.
It's allowing us, as the reader, yes. to assume mm-hmm. that she's reassured right. by the smile,
right.
to infer. Yeah. And that's what I like when I'm reading. I can't bear it when somebody tells me it's a reassuring yeah. smile, you know, because mm-hmm. that yeah. kind of takes it away from me.
I don't know about others, probably, but I think it may be very common for readers. You have a vision in your head after you've yes. read a little bit. You have an idea of what this person looks like. And then if the author goes on to, with a lot of description that negates that, it bothers me and I can't mm. get the original image out of my head anyway. Cause mm-hmm, it's, mm-hmm. And that happens if you read a book and then see a movie. The character is totally mm-hmm. different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think there's some very, very good pointers in this
book. That sounds like a good book, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and not only does it tell you, it shows you with mm-hmm. this.
Good so, example. Yeah.
Good.
Okay. In case you're wondering about any strange noise in the background, we have got the dog Wilfred Owen with us today, and he's yeah. getting a little bit restless.
Yeah, well, talking about restless, after you've rested your manuscript, another suggestion is to listen to it. And again, you know, you can read it out loud, but another way that if you're using technology, you can actually get your computer to read it to you. So on a Mac, you can get the system to talk to you with a slightly different way of doing it. But through Word, you can actually, instead of printing it, you can get it read to you. And it does tend to be in a kind of Stephen Hawking voice, but it's quite good for telling you when you've missed out a comma mm-hmm. or something.
Well, I think recording it yourself, and there are many programs online that you can, if you record it and then listen back to it, I mm-hmm. think you hear, because I just think you can catch it as you're reading and you hear it too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. In fact, Teresa and I went to read for somebody who's written a script, and he said he needed to hear it. Because mm-hmm. obviously it's only in his head at the moment. And we went over and read from his script for him, didn't we?
We did.
Which was fun.
It was very interesting.
But he was saying how useful that was for him, because he could yeah. see where he'd got people not talking enough or mm-hmm. characters not having the right level of exposure and that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah,
so
that
help.
Was really interesting. Mm.
Another quick and easy one, this is something I'm quite guilty of, is I always put two spaces at the end of a sentence. I don't know why. I've always done
that. That was the convention at one time with word processing, but I dropped that a few years ago.
Well, it was, because I remember doing that for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, if you think of your find and replace, if you just go into find and put two spaces mm-hmm. and then go into replace and just put one space, you can get your whole manuscript
yeah.
done
yeah, yeah.
in one go.
Yeah.
That's
A useful tip
too, yeah.
But there are some politicians that insist on their staff using the old way with two spaces.
Right.
That they insist.
But they're not writing novels,
yeah,
are they?
Yeah, that doesn't apply to us.
No. I just thought it was quite comical.
Well,
when
it
I read
is.
It.
Yeah, yeah. Why do they want that, I wonder?
Because, oh no, I won't say what I was going to say. Rather pedantic politician.
They're set in their ways.
Yes.
And of course, people do talk about editing as it's your first draft minus 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So you are looking at, you know, I mean, but that's, you know, when you're thinking, oh, I've got 88,000 words.
It really does depend. It really does depend. I mean, I think that you're right, but the way that we're writing, I don't think there's that much superfluous.
Because we do a lot of editing as we go. Because
yeah,
we're sharing
we help
it
each other
another.
And we share it. We're not working in the, in kind of limbo. So I suspect we wouldn't lose 20%, but who knows?
Okay, so we've done all this editing. We've cut out all the nonsense words and everything. And maybe then if we're self-publishing, we're going to need to employ some sort of editor.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, for some of us, it might be that we go to an editor just for the hell of it to make sure it's in the best possible shape before we start submitting to publishers or agents. And I got quite confused because I went on to Reddit, which is another website, saying, you know, okay, how much will it cost me to get an edit done? There's so many different types of editor offering different editing. So I thought it was worth talking you through some of the different terms. So
yeah, that'd be useful.
The first thing was copy editing. That's really grammar, punctuation and fine-tuning the text, which is a lot of what we've just talked about. So what we've just talked about really is our own copy editing. It's to create the most readable version, but it doesn't look at plot, characterisation, pacing or any of those things. So there's no kind of input in terms of developing the writing beyond. That would be something called a developmental edit, which is a thorough and in-depth edit of the whole manuscript, which is all your elements of writing from overall structure and style, addressing plot holes or gaps, problematic characterisation. Sometimes after a round of developmental editing, you'll find that the manuscript's changed substantially. It can also be called structural editing.
Mm.
So if you see somebody saying they'll do you a structural edit, but that's going to be quite painful because somebody might come back to you and say, you know, I spoke to somebody a year or so ago who was telling me that they'd gone to an editor and the editor had said, rewrite it in the point of view of this character.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, not quite that bluntly, but had come up with a lot of good reasons why the story... And that's a whole rewrite.
Yeah, someone I know had a big rewrite to do when the, you know, publisher said, look, there are just too many points of view. Can you cut it down to two in this particular novel? So that was a big, big rewrite.
Wow. Yeah.
For her.
And that would be an edit, a developmental edit or a structural edit, or sometimes it's called a substantive edit as
But the copy editing, is that what you were just describing?
No.
Because you said copy editing was just to go through.
Copy editing is fine-tuning the text, the grammar, the punctuation, to create the most readable version.
Got it.
Which is what we've been talking about, really.
And the structural is what?
It doesn't look at plot, characterisation or pacing, but developmental editing will look at the whole thing. There's another thing which is called an editorial assessment, and that's a kind of first overview of your manuscript by a professional editor. So they'll read through the entire thing and then provide feedback about plot, characterisation, structure and so on. And again, that can lead to significant changes, but it doesn't go as far as a developmental edit. It's really what you want your editor to do.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's proofreading. That's really the final polish. So once you've done your development, your copy edit, your developmental edit, then you want a proofreader to do it, which is sometimes you get beta readers to do that.
That's really useful, Stephanie.
Yeah,
to give some sort of clarity to the different.
There are
roles.
Other editors, other things editors do, which, for example, they'll help you with your synopsis and your editorial.
Oh, really?
Your query letter.
Mm. Right. Oh, I'm relying on you guys to help me with my synopsis. That's something I have to do.
Oh,
I went on a workshop about doing a synopsis. There are kind of 10 things that you. If you go back,
Stephanie's been on a workshop. We don't need to.
That's right. We'll just come over and have coffee or a glass of wine and just ask her questions and she'll answer
them
all.
I'll have to try and remember them then. Anyway, so I think editing can be a very creative process. And in fact, I was talking to someone at the Manny Litfest, a published author, and she was saying she really loves the editing process.
Yes.
She finds it the most creative part. You know, so she can barely wait to get her first draft finished so she can crack on with the editing.
It must be a great feeling to have a first draft. And something that I'm evolving as a writer to not worry about it being perfect at this stage. And there are lots of things now. And I think I'm going to fix that later.
Yeah.
I'll probably forget when I come to do the edit, but, you know, when I get to the end of the manuscript, I know that there are things I need to fix.
And then, well, of course, Nicola talks a lot about the story grid, which is an editing tool that she's actually used as a way to put the novel together in the first place. Mm-hmm. And what the story grid says is to cut your novel into scenes and to look at every single individual scene and say, this is the rising action or the falling action, and actually analyse.
Yeah, a lot of that is, you know, influenced by screenwriting.
It is, yeah. For me, that would be too rigid. And, I need the freedom to be able to let my characters go off.
I think with any system, you take what works for you, don't you? Absolutely. Take the ideas that appeal to you and you leave the rest.
Yeah. Well, now, what you were talking to someone, you said, at Money Lit Fest, and how she loves editing. Well, after she does it herself, then does she go on to have some of these other, hire somebody to do some of the other?
I think her publisher
does it, but she wants to get it in the best possible shape beforehand.
Well, of course, if you have a publisher already, and if you've published a few books.
Yeah,
that's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're nearly at the end of this week's podcast, but Nicola is going to tell us what's on her bedside table.
So I'm reading A Million Miles in a Thousand Years, What I Learned While Editing My Life by Donald Miller. It's described on the cover as, after writing a successful memoir, Donald Miller's life stalled. During what should have been the height of his success, he found himself unwilling to get out of bed, avoiding responsibility, even questioning the meaning of life. But then, when two movie producers proposed turning his memoir into a movie, he found himself launched into a new story filled with risk, possibility, beauty, and meaning. It chronicles his opportunity to edit his life into a great story, to reinvent himself as a hero, and the review talks about heart-wrenching honesty and hilarious self-introspection, Donald taking readers through his life that emerges. He starts to do things like riding his bike across America, he starts to pursue a young lady that he finds attractive, and he starts to actually live the life that he wishes he could, and that he and his co-writers are shaping his memoirs into. So it's an interesting sort of meta take on someone who only starts to live life once he starts to realise how dull his actual life is, even though he wrote a memoir that was worthy of other people wanting to make into a movie. So yeah, it's all about screenwriting, it's all about screenwriters, it's about people hitting midlife crisis, which is really interesting to me at the moment, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. So that's A Million Miles in a Thousand Years, is What I Learned While Editing My Life by Donald Miller.
Oh, it was good to hear from Nicola again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's very much missed.
Yes, she is.
Well, she's a busy lady.
Well, that was Write Club, the podcast. Thank you to all of you who've taken the time to listen to us. Do get in touch and let us know what you're writing or reading. Subscribe to iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast. Please leave a review and do tell all your friends about us. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.